We have a full schedule. We're going to take several bills this morning. Representative Schoens, Representative Pawlowski's, Representative Drazkowski, and Representative Slocum. Hopefully we'll get done with those, and then we'll come back. We'll recess and come back at 4:30 in room 500 South to finish the agenda. I need a motion to approve the minutes of March 20th. Representative Ward makes that motion. Thank you, Mr. Representative Ward. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. First on the agenda is Representative Schoen, House File 3238. Just which was posted online, just to be clear, we're going to allow Representative Schoen to explain the bill, and then we're going to allow 15 minutes of people testifying in favor of the bill and 15 minutes for those in opposition to the bill. Then we'll take members' questions and we'll vote. And this bill is being referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Representative Schoen.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think if you would, I would appreciate moving the A2 amendment, getting the bill in the shape that I would prefer.
Okay. Representative Schoen moves the A2 amendment.
And then I can give some explanation.
Can we just incorporate that? Or do we have to move forward? Okay, so Representative Schoen moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Schoen, you have an oral amendment to your A2 amendment?
Yes, sir, and I've discussed this with Mr. Diebel, and I think it would be best suited, for it, as technical as it is, I think it would be best suited for him to explain it.
Mr. Diebel, can you explain the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, on page 4, line 23, there's a drafting error. So if you move to that page, you'll need to, page 4, line 23, delete and insert. And then the next part of the amendment is page 4, after line 23, insert the following reviser command. Delete everything after the first the and insert, and that'll make the language fit into the bill.
Could you repeat that, please?
Is this to the A2 amendment, Mr. Diebel?
Yes. What may be confusing, Mr. Chair, is that we're amending the reviser instructions, and so the page numbers that I'm mentioning at first are where it is on the amendment. And the subsequent page numbers are the line page numbers in the bill. So it's telling the reviser where to put the language.
Okay. So there's nothing of substance.
No, these are purely technical, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions on the oral amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now the bill is in the shape that you want it, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2328 is a domestic violence bill that disarms abusers who have been convicted in a court of law. This bill will protect victims of domestic violence and stalking from gun violence and will reduce the number of women murdered with guns each year. First, I would like to be clear about what this bill does not do, because I believe there has been plenty of confusion. This bill does not allow the government to take guns without due process or conviction in a court of law. This bill does not allow for illegal searches and seizures, as some have suggested. The bill strengthens protections for victims of violence by removing firearms from those subject to civil orders or for protection, and those prohibited from possessing firearms due to criminal conviction related to domestic abuse. Under federal law, persons convicted of a domestic violence charge are prohibited from having guns. This bill would allow states to enforce federal law and requires persons convicted of domestic violence charges to surrender their guns. The bill, in conjunction with my author's amendment, does the following. Related to civil orders for protection, the bill provides that those subject to an order for protection in domestic child abuse and domestic abuse be prohibited from possessing a firearm for the length of the order, which mirrors federal law. In order for this section to apply, the bill establishes the following requirements, which also mirror federal law. The order granting relief must be issued after a hearing of which the abusing party received actual notice and at which the abusing party had the opportunity to participate, and the order must, one, restrain the abusing party from harassing, stalking, or threatening the abused party, or restrain the abusing party from engaging in other conduct that would place the abused party in reasonable fear of bodily harm or injury. Include a finding that the abusing party represents a credible threat to physical safety of the abused party, or prohibits the abusing party from using, attempting to use, or threatening physical or for or against the abused party. The bill adds to the list of ineligible persons under state law a person subject to an order for protection and persons who are also disqualified under civil law or federal law. The bill provides that for those individuals convicted of domestic abuse, stalking, assault in the first degree through fifth degree, or assault by strangulation against a family or household member, the court must order surrender of firearms under the provisions of this bill. Under the bill and amendment, the prohibited party must surrender their firearms within 3 business days to a federally licensed firearm dealer, a law enforcement agency, or a third party who may lawfully receive them and does not reside with the abusing party. The bill provides differing standards for firearms temporarily surrendered and those permanently surrendered. If a person temporarily transfers the firearms, an FFL or law enforcement agency may charge a reasonable fee and may establish policies for abandoned firearms, provided they notify the party by certified mail prior to the disposal. Law enforcement FFLs and third parties must exercise due care to preserve the quality of the firearm and must return the firearm upon request after the prohibition period. The return of these firearms must comply with state and federal law. If the abusing party permanently transfers the firearms to law enforcement is not required to compensate the abusing party and may charge the abusing party a reasonable processing fee. The bill requires that an abusing party must file proof of transfer with the court. If the transfer is to a third party, the third party must sign an affidavit under oath before a notary public that they acknowledge the permanent or temporary transfer of the firearms. The affidavit must include the serial number, make, and model of all transferred firearms. The third party must acknowledge in the affidavit that they may be held criminally or civilly liable if the abusing party gains access to the firearms while in the custody of the third party. If the transfer is to law enforcement or an FFL, they must provide the abusing party proof of the transfer, which must include the name of the abusing party, date of transfer, serial number, make, model of all transferred firearms. The abusing party must provide the court with a signed and notarized affidavit or proof of transfer within 3 business days of the court issuing the order. I want to thank both sides of this issue for negotiating in good faith. This author amendments gets us much farther down the road, but I would like to acknowledge that there is still work to be done, and that we'll be doing that between now and the Judiciary Committee tomorrow. I would also like to thank Representative Cornish for playing a role in helping guide this process. We've certainly been in contact, and we continue to be in contact, about some of the things that are still of concern to parties on both sides of this issue. With that, Mr. Chair, I can move the author. We did move the author's amendment, and right now, we can move on to testifiers, as I've explained the bill as it sits in its current form.
Any questions of the author at this point? Representative Cornish.
Representative, Mr. Chair, any of these seizures temporarily or not take place before a conviction, possibly?
Representative Schoen.
So the part related to an order for protection, they would take place after due process. So they would have a court hearing. Otherwise, no, not before a conviction, but at least due process. So if it's a conviction with the crime, yes, that it has to be part of that. But the order for protection piece is they do get a due process. It can't happen before a hearing.
Mr. Chair, just a suggestion. I mean, we really have an amendment ready today, but maybe we could insert alleged abuser in each one of these sentences throughout the document, because it says the abusing party, and it's kind of an assumption if they haven't been convicted yet. So.
Representative Lesh.
Representative Schoen, for an order to be issued, is there some court finding that there was reason to issue the order, reason to believe that there was abuse, albeit not to the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, but was there some establishment by a court in issuing the order that there's reason to believe that, that abuse occurred?
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, thank you for pointing that out. That is absolutely true, that it, there is a hearing that does find that to be the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions at this point? Very good. Representative Schoen, do you have testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure which order they're going to come up, but I have Sarah Gruing of the St. Paul Attorney's Office, City of St. Paul, Mary Klein, and Bree Adams.
Ms. Gruing, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Gruing, and I am the St. Paul City Attorney. On behalf of myself and Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, who couldn't be here this morning, I am pleased to be with you in support of House File 3238. My office handles roughly 1,000 misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases of domestic abuse every year, and the Ramsey County Attorney's Office handles more than 800 felony and juvenile domestic abuse cases each year. Together with the St. Paul Police Department, the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, Ramsey County Probation, the St. Paul Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, and countless other organizations, we are united in this community around a set of protocols called the St. Paul Blueprint for Safety. The blueprint establishes our system's response to domestic violence from that first 911 call that comes in all the way through probation. The blueprint is our interagency effort to prevent domestic homicide in the same way that legislative efforts like this one will ultimately save lives. In St. Paul, we have witnessed firsthand the havoc that domestic violence brings to our community, to our friends, and to our family members. We've also witnessed firsthand the toxic mixture of domestic violence and guns. It is our experience that guns make domestic violence more terrifying. Firearms are an instrument of torture in relationships involving domestic abuse. All too often, our victims report that their abuser threatened that they would kill her or her children if she left. And the presence of a weapon in that home made that threat not just possible, but highly likely. All too often, we see phrases in petitions for orders for protection like, "He has a gun, and I am scared." Guns also make domestic violence more deadly. As you know, a woman is 6 times more likely to be killed in a domestic violence incident if there is a weapon present in her home. The combination of domestic violence and guns affects the entire community. Nearly 60% of all mass shootings, including the incident that happened in a spa in Brookfield, Wisconsin 2 years ago, where 8 people were killed, involve the killing of a family member or a current or former intimate partner of the shooter. Furthermore, if Chief Smith were here, he would tell you that domestic calls are often considered the most dangerous calls that police officers take. A recent 15-year study showed that 14% of officers killed in the line of duty were responding to a domestic incident, and 97% of those officers were killed with a gun. Domestic violence makes up the largest category of calls to which police respond. When that perpetrator is armed, not only is the victim at much greater risk of serious harm or death, but so is the responding police officer. And as you all know, we set a heartbreaking record last year in Minnesota with at least 38 people killed by domestic abusers in 2013, 10 of whom were murdered by gunshots. 12 women were killed in Minnesota by a domestic abuser with a gun in 2011, and 7 were killed by a domestic abuser with a gun in 2012. As such, I am pleased to support House File 3238 and the effort to limit the possession of weapons for those who abuse children, who harass or stalk their significant others, and who make them in fear for their lives. We know it is not a panacea and that some people will still obtain weapons through illegal means. But House File 3238 is an important and crucial step that you can all take this morning to better protect victims, their families, and the entire community. Those who commit the crime of domestic violence have proven themselves to be a serious risk, to their wives and girlfriends, to their children, and to society as a whole, and they should be prohibited from possessing guns. I have no doubt that this legislation will save the lives of Minnesotans, and I am honored to have the opportunity to share my thoughts with you this morning.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Representative Lesh. Ms. Gruen, do you want to come back for a second? I think there's a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gruen, I read in the newspaper, I think it was the other day, about a conviction that was obtained for the assault of a police officer, Officer Felicia Riley, from 2010. And she was savagely beaten when responding to a call. And I had thought that I had read that the assailant and the defendant was the subject of a domestic abuse call, but I don't know if that's the case. Can you confirm if that's the case?
Ms. Gruen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I can confirm that that was the initial call, but obviously the Ramsey County Attorney's Office handled that case. It was a felony, so that's all I can say about that.
Okay, thank you. No other questions.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Green, you know, a lot of statistics and data throwing out, and I guess this question is probably asked quite a bit, but with all the data and the incidences that you reported, is there ever a study done on those guns that were registered or offenders that had registered weapons versus none?
Ms. Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, you know, I'm not sure. From our perspective, the presence of a weapon, whether it be registered or not, that heightens the risk for our victims. And in my lane, that's what we care about.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question on your data here. You said there were 38 deaths related to this. This was last year?
Ms. Gruen?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
And 10 of those were with firearms related to?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
Ms. Gruen, 10
in last year, yes.
Representative Neuberger.
Do you have any data on what the other 28 people were killed with?
Ms. Gruen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I know that I don't. There were multiple stabbings. The Ramsey County Attorney's Office handled several related to blunt head trauma, that sort of thing.
Representative Neuberger.
So just 10 of the 38 were with firearm related, correct?
Ms. Gruen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. I would offer that number is significant to those women and their families, yes.
Representative Neuberger.
No
any other questions of the witness? Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Gruen. Next is Mary Klein, I think, or whoever is. I don't know if you have this organized, Representative Schoen, or I have Mary Klein on my list, but. Yeah. Ms. Klein, welcome to the, you are Ms. Klein, right?
I am Ms. Klein.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm Marianne Klein, Chairman Paymar, Chairman Rosenthal, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity for me to testify. I'm a resident of Minneapolis and a member of the Minnesota chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. I am also a wife, a daughter, the aunt to five nieces, and a mother of a daughter. I thankfully have never experienced domestic violence. Yet, domestic violence occurs every day, all around us, in Linden Hills, in North Minneapolis, in Maple Grove, in Lakeville, in Litchfield, in Mankato. Here in this very room, there are women that are domestically abused every day. Each of us undoubtedly knows a victim of domestic violence, although we may not realize it. Domestic violence is a hidden scourge that we often never find out about until it's too late and the victim has been murdered. Research shows that a victim of domestic violence is 6 times more likely to be murdered if her abuser has access to a firearm. And the presence of guns in a domestic violence situation increases the risk of homicide for a woman by 500%. All women have the right to be safe in their homes and communities. An abused woman's right to her life is more important than the abuser's right to have a gun. While we may not always be able to completely prevent domestic violence, we can do something. You can do something to save lives by acting to make it harder for abusers and stalkers to access firearms. You are acting to save a life of a neighbor, a colleague, a member of your church or synagogue, the life perhaps of your daughter or mine. I urge you to support Senate House File 3238. I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I see any questions, therefore. The next person is Bree Adams. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Bree Adams Bill, and I am a legal advocate at the St. Paul Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. Our agency serves victims of domestic violence, and we serve roughly over 5,400 women a year and take roughly 7,000 crisis calls from battered women each year. And as we all know, it is impossible to predict with certainty when and how a domestic homicide will occur and which batterer will become lethal to their victim. Therefore, as a community, as a battered women's movement in which I represent, and we as advocates, must view all betterers as potentially deadly. It's the only real way to capture any close way of knowing if someone will be lethal or not. We must then rely on the well-documented and researched indicators of lethality, access to firearms being one of them, the threat to use a weapon being another, and the separation of the victim from the perpetrator yet another. The threat to use a weapon and the threat to kill the victim are among the most reliable indicators of lethality, but as a community and in the system, they are often overlooked. We as a community need to examine and close the gaps in our system that may ultimately fail to protect victims from lethal violence. One small way to do this is to modify the domestic violence restraining order provisions to prohibit persons, batterers, subject to restraining orders from possessing weapons, and persons, batterers, convicted of domestic violence offenses. We know that the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence is during separation from the batterer. Thankfully, the system has responded to this by offering a tool for victims to leave a battering relationship by petitioning for a protective order from the court. In doing so, it is crucial to also provide assessment of batter lethality based on the 75% increase of potential imminent harm or death when the victim is attempting to leave that batterer. Of the 25 women murdered by intimate partners last year, though the total was 38 murders altogether, it is important to know that 15 of these women, 60%, were separated or attempting to leave their batterer. In 2012, 43%. 2011, 48%. Of course, the ultimate responsibility, as we all know, for domestic violence murders lies on the perpetrators alone. Each of us knows this for a fact. But let's take advantage of the opportunities for meaningful intervention. As Sarah Gruing testified earlier, in 2013, there was an estimated 45% of domestic violence homicide that were committed by firearms and used in an estimated 50% of the documented Minnesota domestic violence homicides to date. Of women killed in 2013, firearms were used, and they were a great statistic, a great number of women that were killed. 2012, 50%. 2011, 52%. This information comes from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women's Femicide Report. I think it is very clear, and in support of this House File 3238, that the Minnesota statistics support the study showing that possession of firearms can increase the risk of lethality. Whenever there is a history of domestic violence, it is crucial and responsible to look at the question of access to firearms. Finally, just a summary of a story Katie was held against her will for 36 hours. We would look at this as an incident of domestic violence. She was held for 36 hours. During that time, she was raped. She was beaten with a belt. She was strangled by the hands of the person who said he loved her. And she was even stabbed in the ear. But it was the gun he held to her head consistently during this four-year relationship that prevented her from risking her life to escape this life of violence. The mere threat of his legally owned firearm was enough for her to know he would make good on his threats. She often fantasized about dodging his knife or his belt, faking listlessness as he strangled her with his hands, even appeasing him as he took her body against his will, against her will. But it was the gun's higher potential of death that ended these fantasies for her. And there was nothing saying he could not own this gun or have access to it. So the statistics I shared today, I believe, support Katie's very rational fear that her batterer's access to a firearm could have very well been the death of her. The terror Katie lived with did not come out until she filed for an order for protection. And she has gratitude to this very day for being provided the option to do so. But despite leaving her batterer, despite being physically safe today, as we typically define it in society, despite him being ordered to not have contact with her, he still may possess a firearm, and that is the fear that she possesses today. There are thousands of Katies that live in our community with this daily fear. There are thousands of Katies that look to our system to file an order for protection and be provided legal sanctions that will keep them safe. And we have a commitment and a responsibility as a community to respond in a way that supports Katie. We have a responsibility to not allow domestic violence to be accepted or tolerated. We need sufficient and appropriate resources, but we also need these further legal sanctions that restrict batterers from possessing firearms. An investment in the whole spectrum of public safety systems is necessary to reduce domestic violence in our communities. One opportunity to make such an investment we have before us today, you have before you today, which is in support of this bill. We cannot afford to compromise on safety. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Good. Thank you. Representative Schoen, anyone else?
Not on our list, Mr. Chair, and I do apologize. I didn't see what time we started taking testimony, so I don't know where we're in that.
Okay, so stage, I'll...
But I want to make sure that it's fair for everybody.
Yeah. The proponents actually have a couple more minutes, so if there's anyone from the audience that wishes to speak in favor of the bill, please come up now and you can make a brief comment. Otherwise, we will turn to the... I don't know if you're opponents or not, but we'll find out. Very good. Mr. Zappa or Mr. Rothman, who was going first? I don't know who was going first. Oh, I'm sorry. Julie Zappa, that's right. Ms. Zappa, please come up.
Hello,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you for hearing me. My name is Julie Zappa. I lived with domestic violence for over 5 years. There were many scenarios. One particular night, I laid completely still because I had to hold my head still on the pillow while my husband sat over me. And not in rhythmic way, not knowing when it would come, down came the fist, down came the fist. Sometimes it would be right next to my head, hitting the pillow. Sometimes it would graze a cheek, and I could feel it beginning to swell. It might graze my lip, and I could feel the blood and taste the blood in my mouth and the tooth. But I laid there still. There were guns over the years. There was also gasoline. There was a telephone cord. There were his fists. I tell you this short scenario so you'll know that I understand the fear. I personally understand the anger. I don't think about this or talk about this often. I overcame this. This is not me anymore. But I bring it up today because of our Second Amendment rights. I tell you this so you know I understand, but this is not usually, from my experience, usually a man, or an abuser, I should say, wanting to kill the other person. to me, my experience, and I also worked in a battered women's shelter. I went to school to get a human services degree. This is all after I got away from him. I did all this. And from what I saw, this was not so much about killing as torturing and abusing and causing fear. Don't fall for the fallacy. It's a fallacy that a piece of paper will keep me safe. Your good intentions, I appreciate them, but they will not keep me safe. Abusers will find a way to get a gun, whether it's legal or not. This is not, I heard in the last hearing that this is a crime of passion and it's quick acting and that's how a gun, it's so dangerous. These guys just don't go away. It's calculated. They come back again and again. You even heard after separation they can't come back. It isn't about grabbing a gun quick in a fit of passion. They'll find a way to get a gun if they want a gun. I don't want my pain to be used as a stepping stone to infringe upon my Second Amendment rights. And I say mine because what if my gun, which, yes, now I have a gun, what if my gun is in the house? Is that community property? Does my gun get taken away? What about my gun in the house? My rights are part of my power. I had the power the whole time. It was nothing a piece of paper gave me or nothing anyone else could give me. The power was in myself, but not only that, the power is in my rights, my Second Amendment rights, and my constitutional rights. That's the base of my power of a citizen. And I don't want that messed with. I don't want our citizens' Second Amendment rights being chipped away at. And so I want to speak and let you know, not all women who lived through this are proponents of this bill. I have my power. I'd like to see citizens be able to keep their power. I don't want to see an abuser, of course, hurt or shoot a woman, and that's why I told you my story in the beginning. But I just wanted you to get a woman's view from the other side and a gun owner's view, a woman gun owner who had been abused. And that is part of my power, being able to have that gun. And I don't know if this is the right place to ask, but I do wonder on that question. What if the gun is community property? Is that taken away? So I'd like to know that. And thank you for hearing me.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Zappa. The next person signed up is Andrew Rothman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Andrew Rothman. I am the president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I want to start by thanking Representative Schoen for being both a lawmaker and a law officer who's very cognizant of the constitutional rights that we hold and who has worked tremendously hard to craft a bill through the amendments that addresses both the public safety issues and the civil rights issues. And so we want to thank him for that. There are a few technical issues that we still have with the bill. I'm confident that those will be worked out. I just wanted to point out to the committee, and I would like the members to think about this. First of all, this bill largely duplicates federal law, the Wellstone Amendment, and Senator Wellstone was instrumental in getting federal law passed to prevent the possession of firearms by people who've been through due process and who have been found to be abusers. And we appreciate the good faith of the folks who think that this bill would help. But we are concerned about the fixation upon hardware, upon the mechanism, and not upon the intent or the heart of the person who would do harm. We heard in earlier testimony that 10 out of 38 domestic murders were accomplished with the use of a firearm, 26%. Although homicides in Minnesota are down two-thirds since the 90s, and we're a tremendously safe state, In 2011, the last year that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension had data in their reports, 71% of Minnesota murders were accomplished with a firearm. And so domestic murders with a firearm are one-third of the statewide rate. Firearms are not the favorite of domestic abusers because, as Ms. Zappa said, they're not looking to kill. They're looking to inflict fear and pain. And as Ms. Zappa said, no piece of paper is going to keep someone safe. I appreciate the work that you're attempting to do here, but I think that many on the committee would agree that going after the root causes of the abuse, dealing with the emotional issues and the anger, and for Pete's sake, locking up the repeated abusers instead of turning them loose to continue their abuse, would be more beneficial, would be better use of this committee's time than this fixation on certain hardware. Now, we appreciate that the amendments do fix some of the issues with the earlier bill, that the ownership is not transferred unless the owner continues to do so, that the due process has been reinforced with this prohibition taking place only after hearing. We appreciate the removal of the financial burden, which was an initial part of this bill. The problems that remain with this bill are important. We understand the need that law enforcement may want to have the make, model, serial number of these firearms that are dispossessed of the person. But that data should not become public data. And we think that it would be appropriate for the language to reflect that the affidavit of the physical transfer of the firearms be private data under Minnesota law. So it's not part of the public record exactly the make, model, serial number of all of the firearms involved. The other concern that we have is about the timeline. We agree that 3 business days is sufficient time to have the firearms removed from the possession of the subject of the order or of the convicted individual. However, as the language reads right now, it calls for this affidavit, this notification to the court, to happen at that exact same time. We think that it would be fair and just to allow a fair amount of time, perhaps another 3 days, for the notification to be communicated to the court. This wouldn't weaken the bill because the infraction would still occur if the removal did not take place in those first 3 days, but it would prevent somebody from being in trouble over the mechanics of having to fill out the paperwork and get it in front of a notary and get it to the court in the same instant, in the same 3 business days that the physical move. So we would ask that the amendments, when it goes to the next committee, would include a more reasonable period of time to make sure that this doesn't become a paper trap for someone who's acting in good faith. We appreciate Representative Schoen's work, and thank you for making the amendment so fair.
Questions? Very good. Thank you for your testimony. How much time do we have?
It's the same.
Yeah. Chad Nelson, did you want to testify? Okay. We have how much time? We do have 5 minutes left for, is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify against the bill? Mr. Franklin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Don't necessarily want to testify, quote, against the bill, but I do want to raise some concerns that we in law enforcement have. I think the general concept and the idea of what we are trying to do, and I will not try to enumerate all the points that have been made here today, we do express concern. Domestics are a very dangerous situation. For any of us that have responded to them, we've all been through that, and all of us have had either friends, loved ones, or officers that have been injured or killed. in these kinds of situations. They are very dangerous. This particular bill, as proposed, raises issues for law enforcement relative to the storage of the weapons that would come into our possession. We have things in our evidence and property rooms right now that in many cases, extra weapons, depending on what comes in, are going to be very difficult to deal with. Climate control issues with weapons inside are going to require necessary air conditioning, heating, and other things in municipal areas or county areas that we currently maybe don't have. It's extra work for our property clerks and our people taking evidence and other kinds of things in. So there is a cost to doing business with regards to all of this. There's liability issues and concerns about the release of the weapons and how that is going to work and whether or not all of that is going to be requiring a judge's order. If it's a judge's order to get in, does it then require a judge's order to go back out? Who bears those costs, and is that part of what we're going to be ending up dealing with? In the what-if category, if this is part of a domestic and other kind of divorce situation and the weapons become a product of that settlement, how does all of that relate to us in law enforcement as it's divvied out of property? Those are concerns that we think are going to come up and we need to try to deal with. Again, we go back to supporting the concept. It's just, do we need to do this on every single OFP HRO order that's issued? We believe that where there's cause, where there's fear, that should be articulated to a judge. The judge should then assess that and make some sort of decision and then make that order based upon all of the totality of the information as opposed to a blanket one size fits all. So we raise these concerns. I also want to raise another concern that I'm not sure any of us are clear on. In the bill, it talks about a law enforcement agency, but it doesn't necessarily define what that law enforcement agency is. And if I look at the certified law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota, we have PDs, we have sheriffs, we have the BCA, we have the State Patrol, we have the DNR, we have the Department of Corrections, all of who have sworn law enforcement agencies. So when we talk about putting bills in, I guess I'm just a little concerned as to the wording and how that might be interpreted. That might need a little bit more work and clarification. So I think those are the concerns that we have. We certainly understand and support the general concept, but again, we go back to some of the problems that we see that we're going to be running into as a law enforcement storage area.
Any questions? Representative Simon.
Just a quick question, Mr. Franklin. Can't you, under current law or under this bill, can't you charge a reasonable fee to help offset some of the costs of the things that you mentioned? I thought that was the case, but can you clarify?
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe that there is ample room here, or there is room to charge a reasonable fee. Again, I'm not quite sure what that reasonable fee would be and how that's going to be determined. And again, not knowing exactly what each facility is going to have in terms of capital outlay and so on and so forth, I'm not sure how that's going to occur. One of my fears is that we have 400 police agencies. We're going to have 400 reasonable fees, of which somebody is probably going to determine something is unreasonable.
Representative Simon. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is to the author, Representative Schoen. As I read the bill here, it seems like the abusing party has choices in whom they can transfer the firearms to. So in the event that the abusing party went to, say, the sheriff's office to transfer those firearms, it seems to me the way the bill is written that the law enforcement agency has the right to say no. Is that correct?
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simonson, I think in this instance that probably the law enforcement agency would be a fallback. That they, I mean, if they had to go somewhere and they had nowhere else to go, that would be they would probably in this bill be a necessary spot But I think the biggest piece here is that the law enforcement agency would probably want to say to the people, you know, there is an option for you. Do you have a family member or somebody that you could give this to, or a different option versus the law enforcement agency? And that's the biggest piece of this, that there are so many options. I think if you were a small department in a smaller suburb or a greater Minnesota area that doesn't have the storage facility, I mean, you could make it clear that we don't have the best storage facility for your items, and I would highly recommend that you do this with somebody else that you're lawfully able to do so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
And Representative Schoen, I think my point was, and I think you did get to it, but I think if we have the law enforcement agency that doesn't have the capability to either store or the want to store, I think the way the bill is written, and maybe Mr. Diebel could clarify the way it's written, but I do believe the way the bill is written is that the law enforcement agency would have the ability to say no. There are other options in law, either through an FFL or through a third party.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, and maybe that would be help me with some clarification, too.
I was just asking for clarification from Mr. Diebel, so I think I got it, yeah. But maybe the committee didn't. So did you want clarification on this?
Please.
I have it. Representative Diebel. Mr. Diebel.
We got a motion.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, the bill says what the person who possesses the weapon can do with their firearm. It doesn't require a law enforcement agency or a licensed dealer to accept the firearm. So, as Representative Schoen indicated, if the agency was not equipped to handle and meet the requirements of the statute, they could say we don't have the facilities to store them to standard. You'll need to find another agency or a licensed dealer or a third party.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, now you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franklin, isn't it already possible for the court to order pretrial that the defendant, during the pendency of the case, turn over their firearms to the local sheriff or police officer? And so isn't law enforcement already accepting those weapons under current law and under current circumstances?
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, that is correct. We currently are doing it under judge's order. We are currently accepting those weapons. And again, we think that's a duty and obligation, obviously, to carry out the court order. So we are already doing that, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Franklin, how is the liability different in that case than would be in this case?
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, in most of the cases under those, we require a judge's order to reverse that process so that the judge has ordered us to hold those weapons. We ask that they order us to give them back. Again, we have concerns over the care and the maintenance. That is a continuing issue that we're already dealing with and an expense already that we're dealing with without any reimbursement. We don't have a lot of those, but we do have them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schoen, does this do anything to modify that pretrial process, or this is just post-conviction and post-order of the no-contact orders after the hearing?
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, there is due process that is involved, so you do have to have the court hearing, which is the judge's order that says this is the case. You now have the order for protection, and then post-conviction. And that was, Mr. Chair, probably one of the questions I was going to ask Mr. Franklin to expand his statement on related to this. I guess I'm trying to understand by a statement related to the due process, if he didn't believe that we had it in the bill or how it was written in the bill, that he thought we didn't have it in here so that we could clarify, because he made a comment related to that it's a one-size-fits-all, I guess I can't remember exactly what you said, but it made me kind of believe that you had some concerns that there wasn't due process, and I'm wondering if you can point that out to say why you don't believe that. Or maybe that's not what
Mr.
you said.
Mr. Franklin.
And I interpreted it wrong.
Mr. Chairman, I think, I'm not sure, I just got the copy of the second amendment, the A2 amendment here. But it was my understanding that when the HRO or OFP was first ordered and issued, This would be done prior to any hearing. But if it's going to be done after the hearing, then for the judge's consideration, then if the judge then so orders, then we are back to where we are currently with the current judge's order.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
Sean.
Members, and that's an important thing, is that we need to get the information correct before everybody gets too stirred up, is that this does require a hearing. Thank you.
Very good. And we have four more members, and then we're going to vote on the bill. Representative Cornish.
Will there be I don't have a question here, but will there be time for final comment as it goes around? Or?
Sure.
Or do you want me to do it now, or just wait?
We'll have some time for final comments. Okay. If you want to wait, okay. Representative Uglum, do you have a question or you want to make a comment?
A couple questions, Mr. Chair.
Very good.
Thank you. For Representative Sean, this third-party surrender situation, which I think is a good provision in the bill, could you explain that a little more to me? Does this involve where the court order, if you didn't surrender to law enforcement, you would be able to surrender to a responsible party, a friend, a relative, or someone like that?
Chair, Representative Uglum, yes.
Okay.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any provisions in the bill that would make this third party liable for any criminal malfeasance or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, if they would provide the firearm back to the party knowing that the party wasn't supposed to be in possession, basically that there's law now that covers that as well, too. But, yeah, that would be the case in that circumstance. I if you can elaborate more specifically on what liability or they would be breaking the law if they provided it to anybody that what they knew wasn't supposed to have the firearm.
Okay. I think you've covered, Mr. Chair, I think you've covered it. One other question, Representative Sean. I, too, am concerned about the cost and the logistics in terms of storing of these firearms for particularly local PDs, because I think many of them do not have the facilities. I think there'll be a significant cost there, and I would hate to see that the fee, as Mr. Franklin referred to, would vary so much. I know that property rooms in many of these smaller PDs are pretty limited. You yourself are a peace officer, so you know that. I hope we can address some of the cost concerns and the actual logistics concerns somehow in the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Representative Uglum, I think by what Mr. Diebel pointed out, that so if the city of Champlin doesn't want to take them, they don't have to.
Right.
They can work with the other. It's not required in law. More than likely, they probably would, but it's up to them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, my inquiries have been addressed on that.
So okay. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, a couple issues that I have. The overall premise I understand, and it's a good idea to get the people that involved in this have, but with the temporary orders and restraining orders, the ex parte orders, I've been involved in serving all of them, and unfortunately even a temporary order, before the person that's received that order even has a chance to go to court, they have to, a lot of times they have to turn in their firearms to law enforcement, to a friend. Once that, even the temporary order is given, they cannot possess firearms. A lot of times it's right in the order. So they're having to turn in their firearms even before they've gone to court. That's a lot of way these temporary orders read. And unfortunately, a lot of the temporary orders that we serve now, unless that person requests a hearing, it turns into a 1 or 2 year permanent order. I'm hoping that Representative Schoen has requested a fiscal note, because there's some issues that going to affect the court system, plus a lot of issues that are going to affect the local level. Just my department alone, when my chief deputy looked at this bill, he figured it's going to cost, before these amendments were put on, $50,000 to $100,000 for a storage place with the climate control issues to take care of the firearms. Because the liability issue and the value of these guns, it could cost the department a lot of money just dealing with the court issues on the for the liability issues. And so storage space for these is a major issue. But another possible issue that I thought was brought up by Ms. Zappa. It's unfortunate we've had 10 deaths involving firearms in domestic abuse-related issues in Minnesota this last year. And she brought up the fact that if somebody's going to get a firearm, they're going to. I guess one question for the next committee that this bill goes to, I believe it was Ms. Green brought up, of those 10 deaths, if she could find out the statistics of those 10 assailants, or if they're still being charged out, or if they've been convicted yet, what number of them were already previously banned from possessing firearms before the incident occurred?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schoen?
I think it's important. I just want to make sure that everybody on the committee hears this portion. If you're concerned about the storage costs at your local sheriff or police department, if that's the concern, I believe what we've talked about, and Mr. Diebel pointed out, that they don't have to do it. And so that is, I hope that's addressed in the concern. If your sheriff doesn't want to do it, it appears that he's not mandated to do so.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, unfortunately, it's not going to work that way. Or Mr. Schoen. Sorry about that. Right now, the way it works in Isani County, they're doing this system pretty much already. If the person cannot find somebody responsible to take the firearms, then the judge is ordering the local law enforcement agency. If you live in the city department takes it. If you live in the county, the sheriff's office takes the firearms. Unfortunately, neither department has a lot of space issues. And there again comes up to the value of the firearms that they're turning in. And it brings up another issue that they're still trying to figure out how to deal with. That the firearms are in the home that have to be turned in, and it's your son's firearm, and your son now can't go hunting, can't participate with grandpa because his firearms are turned in. So it's not just that person's firearms getting turned in, it's everybody that lives in that household. So it makes it an issue where we have a victim of this that's unintended. So we got a lot of issues to still try to figure out on this bill.
Representative Neuberger, did you have a question or a comment? Because we'll have comments coming up after that then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schoen, question that I have here is going back to the 10 fatalities in related to this in 2013. We have about 5.5 million people in our state, and I'm looking at the numbers here, and these are tragic losses. But if we look at this, you know, numbers wise. The number itself is rather small. My question to you, Representative Schoen, as you researched this, did you come across any data from police reports that indicated any statistical information on how many women's lives were saved or the abuse was prevented from legal firearm ownership?
Representative Schoen.
Hey, if you could clarify, I mean,
Representative Neuberger,
I guess, you know, the only thing I can say, Representative Neuberger, is that 10's too many. And that to say that there's a number, I mean, this is a sensitive topic. And I understand that you're not trying to be insensitive to the issue. And that we take in statistical variables all the time. But the reality is that we know that when we look at lethality assessments and the measurements that continue to come in to law enforcement agencies, that the presence of a firearm really does bring up that measure of saying the likelihood of them using it in that scenario is very much higher than if it wasn't there. I understand what you're getting at, but the fact remains that it's still there. Let's get past the fact that this is not about protecting law-abiding gun owners. These folks that are here to advocate on this are law-abiding gun owners. We're going after not law-abiding gun owners. Completely different scenario. I don't want to take away guns from law-abiding gun owners, but the fact remains that abusers, they don't deserve them. If you beat women and children, you don't deserve to have your gun.
Anything else?
Okay.
Comments, and then we'll take a vote. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, first of all, thank you for having a orderly hearing, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schoen, for being open-minded for change and possible amendments. But I would just really quick want to explain to you the alleged paranoia, the gun group here, and why they're so worried is that basically in the 70s they said they're never going to come after our long guns, and then not too long ago they did come after the long guns. And I won't mention them by name, but there's three chiefs of police on this letter of support that have a very bad reputation for being against gun owners. One of them was an NPR interview that stated, I'm going to get in trouble with gun groups on this statement, but I'm for registration of all firearms. So that's where when you hear a lot of the paranoia of gun owners, it comes from well-reasoned past experiences. And so that's why we're worried about the bill. Thank you for working on it, and I hope you will continue in the Judiciary Committee to make some changes to it. So.
Any other comments before we vote? Representative Ugham. Ugham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick one. Representative Schoen, I'd like to commend you for working with the Gun Owners Alliance. I think this is a much better bill for both sides since it first came out. I think it still needs a little bit of work. It's certainly well-intentioned. I just a thought for you to work on, too. In terms of the data, Mr. Franklin brought that up. I do have concerns about registration of serial numbers and so on and so forth. I would think that a simple tag that would be difficult to remove on these guns for inventory purposes and things might be sufficient. But we do have to respect Second Amendment rights on this thing, and I think anything that we can do to achieve a good balance would be good, and that might help. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no, I. Representative Schoen, I'll echo what's also being said. Accolades to you for pulling this all together. I know it's been difficult in working with several sides of the issue, actually, and I hope this bill can move forward and we'll move it to the floor. But first, it's going to the Judiciary Committee. So, Representative Schoen, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all the members of the committee for our respectful dialogue around this issue. I think one of the comments that I hear several times related to our laws are, you know, you have the laws on the book, let's enforce them. One of the things that we do have an issue of is what's federal law and what's state law, and then as state law enforcement agencies, we do have a very difficult time enforcing federal law and taking those things to court and getting them prosecuted as necessary. I am not here to take away anybody's civil rights. I'm here to protect domestic violence victims and look at the what we can do that's in law already that we can bring to the state level so that our local law enforcement agencies and courts can also protect those victims in an appropriate manner that protects everybody's civil rights.
Thank you. So Representative Schoen renews his motion that House File 3238, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Next is
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you.
John, this is a pretty good bill. Well, I could go get a cup of coffee.
That's the end of it.
Okay, welcome, Representative Plowski. I will move your bill, House File 2701. And it appears that an oral amendment did not get into this copy of the bill, so we're going to do that first, if you don't mind.
Mr. Chair, you're moving it to Ways and Means, I assume?
Yes. So on line 6.3, after the state, the chair will move strike or and insert and.
Say that again.
On page 6, line 3, after the state, strike or, and insert and. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Blowski, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill has been worked on since actually before the special session of 2013. To address an ongoing problem that we've had of repetitive special sessions when a relatively small amount of money needs to be appropriated in a special session simply does not rise to the level of what we are dealing with in the disaster that is occurring in Minnesota. So this bill does basically two things. The first is it creates a disaster fund, and that mechanism can be triggered two ways. The first is that there would be a standing appropriation of approximately $6 million, and you see that in the supplemental budget of the House. That $6 million is the average of the last nine or so disasters in Minnesota, and that would then allow the mechanism of disaster to be put into place if we would need a special session. Of course, a special session can be called. When a regular session would occur, if we would need to appropriate more money beyond that, the, I think, big advantage of the bill is we would now be working with accurate numbers. When we call a special session, we are working off estimates. These estimates vary. You have seen in other committees that sometimes they vary by quite a bit. For those of us that have had disasters in our area, you know that these are estimates that are done not with any intent to be off, but to make sure that we address whatever harm has been occurred in the private and public sectors that we are responsible for in Minnesota. Secondly, we've created a new type of recognition of a disaster, and that's 12B, where the governor could, and you can see the mechanism in place, call a disaster, and this would then also work in some areas where those disasters have been narrow in scope, and yet the local units of government, whether that be a county or a city, could not cope. So, Mr. Chair and members, that is the bill. I want to draw your attention to the list of testifiers. I'm not going to call them all up today. All of these individuals have attended at least six meetings before session. Senator Cohen is the chief sponsor of the bill in the Senate. In these meetings, we round-robin this bill with as many as 13 different agencies prior to the start of session, and particularly one person, the Director of Homeland Security. Director Ide has been the point person for both the governor's office and for the agencies involved. So with Senator Cohen, I want to make sure I extend my thanks to him and also to Director Ide for the work that has been done prior to the legislative session. And members, that's the bill.
Questions from members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pelosi, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I have a question regarding, I think it's really a good bill. And I have a question regarding, you know, the appropriation, and I didn't see what it is. I don't know if you mentioned it or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, it would be $6 million. Okay. And that $6 million, and I can have
Director Ide come up and explain where that $6 million comes from, but that would be the average of the last 9 disasters or so and what it would take to make sure we could start doing matching aid if we needed to and other things for the direction of the agency. So,
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Pelosi, thank you for that answer on the $6 million. My question regards, you know, the recent flooding that we had, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, touched my county, and Director Ide talked to on the phone quite a bit about that issue, and was very, very helpful. And the federal government, as you have indicated, Representative Pelosi, the federal government, you know, isn't able to help, you know, smaller areas that were still devastated, okay? But would this appropriation go towards private citizens? I had a number of private citizens who, Director Ide knows this, were devastated within their own home location. So is this money just to local unit governments for their purposes only? Or could it? Would there be some help to private individuals as well?
Asking that question. Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I'm going to give you my initial answer, and that would probably be no, because this is for public sectors, but I can have Director Ide come up and answer in specificity. This is a complex issue. We are working with FEMA, and we are working with a variety of agencies. In some cases, there may be assistance, but I'm going to let the director respond to your question.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Ide, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Representative Ward, in response to your question, this does not include individual and households program. This we are starting off with a public assistance program that will help communities. And as Representative Pelosi said, it really is to avoid having to call a special session when, particularly when summer storms happen, that devastate communities.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Representative Pelosi. Thank you for bringing this this bill forward. There's a lot of sentiment from it after the last time we went through this that oftentimes people just want. They don't want us to meet. They just want us to do something. So I think that this appears to be a step in the right direction. The only question I have is, I didn't see it in the bill, and maybe you could point it out to me. How long is the timeline or the trigger from the time of the disaster to the time as you would anticipate seeing the aid arrive? I mean, we had a series of storms early in the summer, and then it wasn't until September that, you know, they were able to get everybody down here, and just a ballpark figure, if you could tell us what people would look like as far as the time is concerned on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm going to let the director answer that question because I don't know if there is one answer to that question. So I'm going to let the director.
Mr. Ide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, there really is two answers. The first answer is if this contingency account is used to match the not.
So, I'm going to let the director.
Mr. Ide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, there really is two answers. The first answer is if this contingency account is used to match the non-federal share of a presidentially declared major disaster, the timeline will not change very much because of the process of getting the project worksheets in and the FEMA paying their share. If it is, for the second reason for this bill is having a contingency account and a state-run public assistance program for those disasters that are still serious to the community but do not meet the FEMA threshold, I believe we have up to 60 days in order to collect the information, 30 days for the applicant to apply, 30 days to review, and then get the invoices and the payment through. So it should be a lot shorter time frame than a federally declared disaster.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as far as who actually makes that declaration, whose final responsibility is that it is a disaster?
Director Ide.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, this would be a gubernatorial disaster declaration program. So the applicant then would provide all the information as if we were FEMA. The local unit of government would then provide all that information. Governor would declare a state disaster, and then we would administer the public assistance program.
Any other questions from members? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify in favor or against this bill?
Yeah, I don't think we need. Mr. Chairman, we have a number of people who have worked very hard on it. I'm not going to force them to come up and testify because of your agenda. I think the bill speaks for itself.
Representative Pawlowski, I understand. So I will renew my motion that House File 2701, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
We are waiting on Representative Joskowski, but Representative Savick, do you want to?
My testimonies have left because.
Okay. Then.
How about you?
What happened? No. Roll call in another committee.
You got one.
That too. Reverend Slocum?
Oh, so they're waiting today?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my
we have a few minutes.
Not here. However, it's a very non-controversial bill.
Let's do it.
All right.
And then he won't have to come, and he'll be even
gun in the.
Oh, here's Representative Joskowski. Sorry.
Were you expecting someone else, Mr.
Anyone but you, Drax.
Sorry, I didn't meet expectations.
Where is this going? Welcome, Representative Joskowski. I will move House File 1915, and it is on its way to rules after us, I do believe. So, all in favor? Representative Joskowski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, actually the idea was brought to me by a constituent, and coincidentally I learned after talking with the Post Board that they have been in discussions actually with the National Governors Association. Mr. Melton here? And maybe he can, you're probably in a hurry, he can testify quickly, but this takes the number of years of military duty in military police type activity that veterans need to have in order to qualify for civilian police reciprocity in Minnesota. It takes it from 5 years to 4 years, and there's no known opposition to the bill. Mr. Melton.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. And as Representative Draskowski said, this actually began last fall in a meeting in Washington, D.C. Minnesota was one of six states awarded grants by the National Governors Association to create more effective pathways for veterans seeking jobs in certain occupations. The goal of the conference was to ensure that current and former military service members in Minnesota have the most efficient and effective pathways to employment by increasing opportunities and licensure and certification. In Minnesota, three occupations were chosen. It was law enforcement, nursing, and emergency medical technician slash paramedics. At the conference, there were six states. We're joined by a number of representatives from federal agencies, including the National Guard, Department of Defense, Department of Labor, Veterans Affairs, Department of Education, and others. Each state made a presentation on their current policies and procedures that serve veterans. Overall, Minnesota was complimented on our current practices as they relate to the reintegration of military members into education and jobs. In the end, it was the recommendation of the conference attendees that Minnesota revise Statute 626-8517 to bring it in line with military enlistments. In general, the change reduces the service or the combined service and education requirement from 5 years to four, and also changes the phrase active service experience to cumulative service experience in order to qualify members of the National Guard and Reserve. The language encompasses three scenarios: those with military experience only, those with military experience and college degree, and those with military experience and civilian law enforcement experience in another state. On January 23rd, the Minnesota Post Board voted unanimously to support the proposed changes. Any questions?
Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drakowski, is this going to be the same reciprocity test that they currently give to individuals that come from other states that have law enforcement experience?
It is, Mr. Chair and
Representative Drakowski.
And Representative Johnson, it is, and I believe that that's outlined in the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Drakowski, Mr. Chair, thank you. I am in favor of this bill, especially with the changes to the para for the police and fire fund that we did last year. I have a lot of concern because of that bill that we're going to have a lot of public safety issues with the amount of law enforcement officers that are going to be retiring by May 31st this year. The way the current post board is set up, they have about three individuals eligible for each position that's open. But with the number that possibly openings we could possibly have come May 31st, I don't believe that number is going to be met. It's not even be close to being met. So this might be an opportunity to, one, help our veterans, to get them into employment when they come back or return from duty, and also to help with our public safety, the giant hole I believe we're going to have very shortly. And just one other question I have, is this just for full-time military personnel, or is this going to also include the Guard and Reserve?
Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, it does include the Guard and Reserve, too, and that's also included in the bill.
Any other questions from members? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 1915 be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, we are going to reconvene this afternoon. Do people have time to do a quick Representative Slocum bill? Welcome, Rick. Welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move, 2928 to go to judiciary after this stop.
the amendments. And do you want to move your amendment?
I would. There is an A14-0978 amendment. I would like to move the amendment to make the bill in order.
All those in favor of that?
Do you want me to explain the amendment, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Okay, briefly, I have one sentence. I mean, it's easy. This just clarifies the driving while impaired statutes to be considered. Just clarifies. Doesn't change. Clarifies.
Thank you. All in favor of the amendment specified by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Slocum to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a technical amendment, or this is a technical bill that doesn't change anything except clarifying. So it's perfect for the unsession, so to speak, unsession. The purpose of this legislation is to separate the criminal vehicular homicide and criminal vehicular operation offenses into two separate statutes. This will enable the judicial branch to transmit necessary information more effectively to the Vehicle Services Division, the Department of Public Safety. Currently, all of this information cannot be transmitted electronically, and court staff must manually transmit some information to the Department of Vehicle Safety, Vehicle Services Division. Separation of the two offenses will provide more accurate information in public court calendars. Thus, judges, court staff, and the public will not mistake a criminal vehicular operation case for a more serious criminal vehicular homicide case. The Department of Public Safety was consulted on this legislation and supports it. I will now not turn over to my testifier because my testifier is not here. But it's going to save Chief Judge, 4th Judicial District, Peter Cahill, a trip here.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Any questions from members? Is there anybody in the audience like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Slocum renews her motion that House File 2928 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the committee. Recommended to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. Thank you, members.
And where are we? You want to do another? what time are we reconvening? Where?
Recess.
Okay, we're going to recess into 4:30 in room 500 south. So this committee is in recess.
Public Safety Committee is back in session here. We adjourned earlier and we completed most of our agenda. We only have a few bills to take up for this afternoon and we'll be done because one bill, House File 2156 on the forensic laboratory accreditation, has been moved until tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll also be taking up the supplemental budget bill. I met with Representative Cornish and shared the spreadsheet with him, and we'll have the policy will be forthcoming. So, Representative Sadek, are you ready to do House File 2972?
Sure.
There was the Hortman bill while we're waiting for the author. So Representative Savick, you want to move your bill?
I'd like to move my bill to, where do I move it to?
It goes to Ways and Means.
I move my bill to Ways and Means. And thank you for hearing this bill. The bill is about the fire safety account.
Just want to make sure, is this on?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. The bill is about the fire safety account, which was established in 2006,
as a place for the deposit insurance of homeowners of certain commercial insurance policies. The bill is used, the fire safety account is used by the Minnesota Board of Firefighters for training and education, programs and staffing for the State Fire Department, State Fire Marshals Division, and fire-related regional response team programs and other fire safety programs that have potential for statewide impact. It is run by a fire service advisory committee, and they advise how they should use the money. The advisory committee was inadvertently eliminated with a host of other advisory groups and is recommended for reinstatement. In addition, they have supplementary appropriations of $1.3 million in the account, and it's necessary to put these to use the funds sitting in the account, and so this would allow us to use those funds to appropriate those funds. I have with me today two testifiers, Chief George Ebsen and Chief Tim Butler, and I'd like to turn it over to them.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chairman, good evening to you tonight.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Tim Butler. I'm the fire chief of the city of St. Paul. The 475 men and women of the St. Paul Fire Department provide a full range of fire, rescue, and EMS services to the Capitol and to the city of St. Paul. We also staff and support a wide variety of statewide specialized response teams that are noted in the bill, including one of the state's 10 chemical assessments teams, the state's only emergency response team for hazardous materials, and one of four units, or one of five units, that's associated with Minnesota Task Force 1, specializing in collapsed building rescues. I'm here today representing those specialized teams and those men and women of St. Paul, but I'm also here to represent two statewide fire service professional organizations. The first is the Minnesota Fire Association Consortium, or MINFAC, embodies roughly all 20,000 firefighters throughout the state of Minnesota. And the second one, the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs, I sit on the executive board of that, and that represents roughly the 2,000 fire chiefs and fire chief officers in the state of Minnesota from the nearly 800 fire departments throughout the state. The fire service organizations and the statewide specialized response teams asked me to come here today. They asked me to convey to you their unified support for House File 2972. These bills ensure that the Fire Service Advisory Committee continues to exist without a sundown, and that the Commissioner of Public Safety does not expend the funds from the fire safety account without the support of that advisory committee. The Fire Service Advisory Committee was established along with the fire safety account by the 2006 Minnesota Legislature as a means of ensuring that members of the Minnesota Fire Service were trained, equipped, and prepared to protect the homes, the personal property, and the businesses, and the lives of Minnesota residents. As Representative Savick testified, subsequent legislative action designed to clean up and sundown some of the advisory boards and commissions in the state inadvertently sundown the Fire Safety Advisory or Fire Service Advisory Committee. State officials neglected to inform the commissioner that that committee had been sundowned, so the committee continued to provide valuable recommendations to the DPS commissioner for more than 2 years, including the recommendations that are included in today's bill. I have a handout here. Provides the committee's recommendations for the unallocated $1.3 million contained in the author's bill. These recommendations were made to the DPS commissioner on October 31st, 2013, and the commissioner concurred with our recommendations. And if I could have somebody provide these to the committee and the chair.
Yeah. Sean, can you, or we need a page to pass these out. Thank you.
I'm sure you have one too. Mr. Chair. I'll continue if that's all right.
Please
members
do.
Of the committee can refer to the handouts being passed out. The recommendations were that $450,000 from this allocation be provided to the Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education, or the MBFTE. It provides reimbursement for firefighter basic and advanced training on a variety of topics, but it's focused really on the fundamental building blocks of Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2. Fire safety count currently provides roughly $85 per firefighter in the state through the MBFTE reimbursements. The additional allocation called for in the advisory committee's recommendations and the author's bill would bring that level of per firefighter training up to $100. That still falls far short of the more than $325 spent on every Minnesota peace officer in the state through the post board. The bill, also the second bullet point there, includes $350,000 for Task Force 1 training and equipment. That Task Force 1 is a statewide collapse rescue team. It's composed of one heavy rescue team and four medium rescue teams. Elements of the team have responded to a variety of collapsed buildings, specialized rescue like trench and cave rescues, and other specialized rescue situations involving high angle and low angle ropes. $200,000 was recommended to provide the fire service with grants that promote closer cooperation between departments and between fire service agencies. So we're talking about better collaboration, better cooperation, and consolidation of some of our fire service in the departments in the state. $80,000 is requested for the Minnesota Aviation Rescue Team. That's a cooperative partnership that was formed at the DNR's request between the State Patrol and the City of St. Paul. Essentially, we provide rope-trained rescuers that are paramedic specialized rescue folks. The Minnesota State Patrol provides a helicopter, and now we have a very rapid deployed insertable via rope rescue team that can go rescue responders from DNR during fires, can go search and recover victims from the wilderness, or go on to buildings or bluffs and make specialized rescues. $120,000 is reserved in the bill for support of the statewide hazardous materials response teams. Again, there's 10 chemical assessment teams. Those teams are seven-man teams or seven-person teams that go out and rapidly assess what's leaking, what's spilling, what's creating a vapor cloud. They make a monitoring situation. They figure out what do we need to do to mitigate the situation, and they perform basic containment like putting up dikes and making sure that runoff into streams isn't impacted. There's one emergency response team that's kind of the heavy-duty team, if you will. 14 members go in, and they can patch the holes, plug the holes, and make other mitigation efforts. The final $100,000 in the bill of unallocated collections would be used for the State Fire Marshal's Office so they can enhance technology both in the office and the field, primarily designed to make sure that all fire departments in the state are reporting incidents back to them so they can create a comprehensive database of what are the fire departments in the state doing and what type of responses and incidents are they responding to. The handout also mentions the strategic plan developed by that Fire Service Advisory Committee. It further highlights the significant needs and the planned expenditures from the fire safety account, and that plan is available for your review, and I can certainly make sure that members of the committee get a chance to look at this strategic plan. But this is roughly a five-year plan that says this is how we think the fire safety account should be allocated. The plan is ready. We need your support today to ensure that funding is available to make the strategic plan a reality for firefighters and citizens in the state. The reason the Fire Service Advisory Committee is approved to be so valuable for the commissioner is because the committee's membership offers a broad perspective and deep experience that extends far beyond the fire service. Members representing counties, townships, and the insurance industry, and both metro and outstate areas, add significant context and information to fire service and public safety discussions. The unique committee composition ensures that the recommendations on how best to expand the fire safety account both serve and balance the needs of all Minnesotans. There's no cost for the Fire Service Advisory Committee. All members serve as volunteers with their time and their talents. The Fire Service Advisory Committee enjoys a broad bipartisan support in areas all across the state, from outstate, rural, suburban, and urban. Both the committee and the fire safety account were established by the Minnesota State Legislature to ensure that firefighters received adequate training and were ready to go for any emergency. The author's bill being supported here today does not provide any additional funds, or it doesn't create any new funding stream. It simply asks for your authority to allocate the funds already collected and intended for the fire service. Eden Prairie Fire Chief George Espenson is joining me today. He has additional information for you regarding the fire service account. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Chief Butler. Any questions of the chief? Okay. Would you like to testify, please? Could you state your name, and I think we might have it spelled wrong, too. I'm not sure, but we need it for the record.
Great. My name is George Espenson, E-S-B-E-N-S-E-N. I'm the Eden Prairie Fire Chief. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association, the Minnesota chapter of the IAAI, and in addition, I bring the support from the MPFF, the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. Just a brief overview, for those of you who may not know, Minnesota ranks 47th in the nation in spending on the fire service, and yet we rank 20th in population. One of the reasons for this great value is our very strong paid on call or volunteer fire service that makes up about 90% of the Minnesota Fire Service are not career firefighters. So we're already leveraging a very good value there on our citizen volunteers. Thus far, since 2008, the fee has generated $6 million in 2008, $12 million in 2009, which was a full year, 08 was a partial year. $12,165,000 in 2010, and in 2011, $12,853,000. However, all those funds have not been, as you know, historically, going to the fire service. They've been used for other purposes. The funds also support the State Fire Marshals Division. It's the only state agency that receives no general fund dollars. And currently, $4.3 million is the base appropriation for the State Fire Marshals Office. Fire Service developed a strategic expenditure plan for the fire safety account revenues, as Chief Butler has showed you, and we'll be happy to provide those to you. A brief summary of the training recommendations contained in the strategic plan include training all Minnesota firefighters to the Firefighter 1 and 2 standard. That's about a $20 million cost because the fire service is constantly turning over. It's obviously not a young person's avocation, and so when firefighters reach age 50 or earlier, typically they are out of the fire service. That's very typical in the small rural greater Minnesota area. So we constantly have turnover amongst our ranks, and those people need to be retrained. Incident command training, $3.6 million. Leadership training, as you know, the backbone of any great organization is its people and the professional leadership to lead those organizations. That's another $3.6 million. Advanced training, and then that equals a total of $34.7 million. So as you see, the $1.3 million is really very integral to the ongoing viability of our very great bargain we have in the Minnesota Fire Service and supporting those men and women, predominantly volunteer firefighters, citizen volunteers, local people that rush in when everyone's rushing out. And we would appreciate your support in this bill.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Chief Espenson. Any questions of Chief Espenson? Chief Butler, did you have more comments, more testimony?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to make just a quick closing comment. Again, on behalf of the 20,000 members of the Minnesota State Fire Service, we do urge you to adopt House File 2972. In addition, the Minnesota Fire Service members want to extend their sincere appreciation to Representative Sadek, to Representative Cornish, and Representative Tamar for your authorship of this bill and their enduring support of the Minnesota Fire Service. This committee's continued leadership in protecting Minnesota homes and businesses from fires, disasters, and a host of man-made natural disasters reflect the very deepest core values and the top priority of the Minnesota Fire Service agencies and the entire American Fire Service. So we thank you for your time this evening, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Savick, do you have any closing comments? Well, let me ask, is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Okay, Representative Savick?
No, just that this is a good bill, and I'd like to see it passed.
Okay. Very good. Representative Savick renews her motion that House File 2972 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative Savick. Representative Hortman is still presenting a bill, Sheriff, so you'll just have to wait unless... We could do Representative Rosenthal. Do we have your bill ready? Why don't we do yours? Representative Rosenthal, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2447.
Is it 2447.
I'm sorry. I never referred to the General Register.
I think. Is there... why is it going to Ways and Means? Is it Is there someone from DOC here? Assistant Commissioner Carlson, can you why don't you come up, because we want to let Representative Rosenthal introduce his bill, and then if you could just testify to the fiscal note, that would be helpful, just so we know where we're going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is pretty simple. It comes out of an incident of a correctional officer named Dave Campa, who was assaulted while on duty and is permanently disabled. And what this bill does is provide medical contributions to him until age 65. He can't work. He has bills of $1,600 a year, and it's my understanding that the Department of Corrections was going to handle this internally.
Can you testify to that? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division for the Department of Corrections. The cost of this bill is $17,000 per year, and that would be a cost that we could absorb within our agency.
So maybe we should have... I just wanted to ask the question about what... And I know about the individual case, and Mr. Campa, you'll be testifying in a moment, right?
Mr.
Kajiska, what am I saying here? Was this? This was Campa was the person who was injured. Yeah. So Mr. Campa was the one who was injured. So are there other individuals at the department that might be affected, could be affected by this in the future? I guess that's what I...
Mr. Chair, it is possible that others could be affected. I'm not aware of any others at this time, but there are others that could be.
Mr. Chair, this really brings...
Representative Rosenthal. The
police department and fire department as well, I believe. As far as making payments for disabled officers or injured.
Why don't we hear from Richard Kujes, I can never pronounce your name. Didn't even get it right the first time around, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You did get the first name right. That's more than enough. Mr. Chair, members, Richard Kajewski, MAVE's Public Affairs and Communications Director. Thank you for the opportunity. The bill before you today is a result of an unfortunate situation. Many of you have seen one of the two stories on CARE 11 regarding Mr. Campa. He is a former employee of the Stillwater Correctional Facility. He was assaulted by an offender in a segregation overflow unit. As a result, he suffered a level 3 concussion. He's totally and permanently disabled as a result of the incident and has endured over 3 years of major medical treatment, some of which continues today. He suffers from traumatic brain injury. He's got a steel plate in the back of his head. He suffers from seizures, migraines, TMJ, and continued disorientation. He went through nearly 2 years of constant medical appointments and evaluations before being rendered totally and permanently disabled. Members, as many of you know, firefighters and law enforcement officers injured in the line of duty, along with their spouses, are provided employer-paid health insurance. And employees who work in a correctional facility risk their lives each and every day, but are not afforded that same benefit. This bill only takes a small step in that direction. It allows only some correctional employees an opportunity to receive an employer-paid portion of their health insurance if an offender assaults them and leaves them totally and permanently disabled. So as I said, this is the beginning of something. This bill does not provide the full extent of benefits that law enforcement officers or firefighters are eligible for today. I assure you, every correctional facility employee takes a calculated risk every day they go to work. However, no employee goes to work wondering if they're going to jeopardize their family's livelihood and everything they have worked for all their lives. The campers live every day wondering what personal possessions they're going to have to sell in order to continue health insurance, which is needed given Mr. Campa's condition today. This circumstance would leave any Department of Corrections employee in the same position as Mr. Campa, unable to provide for his family and required to pay the additional $1,600 a month for insurance for doing his job. And I'm here today to make sure that nobody ever has to endure more sleepless nights resulting from a situation like this one. Mr. Campa would prefer to be at work right now rather than sitting in this hearing wondering what's going to happen to this bill. You may believe that this testimony is all about one person and all about one unfortunate incident. It's just as much about the next person down the line. The language is restrictive in this bill. It was requested that it be restrictive initially, and I think going forward it's going to take a little bit more study, and it's going to be a much bigger task before us to include all employees in correctional facilities, but it's one that I'm up to. As I said, it's a start. There's an agreement from all parties involved initially here to start with that, and that includes the governor. Mr. Chair and representatives, I'm happy to stand for questions, but I'd like to leave you with the words that I've heard from both Mr. Campa and Mrs. Campa on separate occasions when I talked to them individually. The words are short but powerful, and they said, "We can't let this happen to anyone else."
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kujewski. Any questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, why isn't this a workman's comp situation?
Mr. Kujewski.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, it is a work comp situation. His workman's compensation has run out. He's currently involved in some litigation with workers' comp. That's an insurance element. I can only tell you my most recent update from speaking with the campus. The workman's comp is not even going to begin to cover his medical payments. The plate in the back of his head was $80,000. Work comp is not even covering that right now.
So, Kelly.
No, thank you.
Other questions of Mr. Kujewski? That's good. Anything else from the department? No. Representative Rosenthal, any closing words?
No, just thank you, members, and this is a good step in the right direction, and I guess I'm not sure where I'm referring to.
I guess it's going to the general register if it doesn't have a cost to the department. So, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor of the bill or in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 2147 be placed on the general register. Mr. Kujewski, thank you for your testimony, and thank you, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay, now I think we're ready. Representative Hortman.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, and Sheriff Stanek and Judge Quam, I apologize for the delay. I had two bills up in two other committees, and it's really Representative Uglum's fault that it took so long because he had a lot of questions for my bill in Representative Dill's committee.
So the chair will move House File 2562. This is going where? This is going to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, as I understand, right?
Mr. Chair, that's a surprise to me, but if Representative Liebling would like to see it, then that's fine. Well. We can send it there, and if Representative Liebling doesn't need to see it, then we can move it on the floor on Wednesday to where it's supposed to be.
Okay. Representative Hortman, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill I'm carrying for Senator Goodwin. Respectfully requested that I introduce this bill. And I understand that Chair Stanek and others have been working on this issue for a long time and that they're in support of the bill, so I will let them speak to it because they can probably do a better job than I can.
Sheriff, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Judge Quam and I will get it done. For the record, my name is Rich Stanek, and I'm the sheriff in Hennepin County. I'm going to keep my comments real brief, Mr. Chair. I know you want to get the heck out of here. So, Judge Quam and I are here both to speak in favor of House File 2562. Our offices have been working closely with Hennepin County Judge Jay Quam, our friends at NAMI, and other stakeholders to discuss the issues of mental illness in the criminal justice system. I have provided the committee an article that I wrote about a year or so ago, a jail is no place for the mentally ill. We've made some great strides during this last year, Mr. Chair and members, specifically in passing legislation to mandate a 48-hour placement for court-ordered mental health treatment. And we've been working with Representative Hillstrom on another proposal to speed up the time mentally ill inmates are spending time in our jail. However, Mr. Chair and members, these law changes will all provide some help in alleviating the problem, but are not the big picture or the silver bullet solution that everybody's looking for. There's much more work that needs to be done. As the sheriff of the county, I'm responsible to run a jail, the largest jail in Minnesota. We book about 35 to 40,000 people through the front doors. And every year, there are approximately, like I said, about 35,000 inmates. About 25 to 30% of those conservative numbers suffer from treated or untreated mental illness. And Mr. Chair, members, that's really the crux of this. Often our jail staff must operate as frontline mental health workers, and it's a challenge for them. And I'm hearing the same thing from my sheriff counterparts nationwide and across the state. Jails have become, without a question, our nation's largest mental health care facilities. And although our jail staff, Mr. Chair, members, have won, you know, national awards for the treatment of those inmates with mental illness, a jail is not the place for the mentally ill. We support the creation of a working group to more closely monitor and examine the establishment of a hub where certain lower-level offenders can receive the mental health treatment and support they need rather than being booked into a jail facility where their condition continues to worsen and they spend months and months recycling in and out of the criminal justice system and the jail without ever getting the help that they need for their mental illness. Again, Mr. Chair, members, we believe strongly as sheriffs across the state that the mentally ill should not languish in our jails for weeks and even months waiting for their proper care. I want to thank Representative Hortman and Senator Goodwin, Judge Quam, and NAMI for working together to bring this concept of a hub forward. This is a significant issue, Mr. Chair and members, as we've discussed before. I thank you for your patience and diligence taking a close look at it.
Thank you for your testimony, Sheriff. Judge?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Representative Hortman said, my name is Jay Quam, and I'm a judge of the Hennepin County District Court. I've been a judge for almost 8 years, and at the outset, what I want to make sure that I make clear is that even though I expect most of my colleagues would agree with my views, I'm not speaking on behalf of the judicial system or anything like that. I'm speaking as a judge who's handled cases in virtually every area of the court system and who's become very sensitive to the fact that people with mental illness come into every area of the courtroom very frequently and very tragically, but none more so than when they come into the criminal justice system. As Sheriff Stanek has just said, the end result of that combination of people with mental illness and the criminal justice system means far too many people who are mentally ill are brought to jail, and far too many people with mental illness languish there. Thanks to the work of Sheriff Stanek and Sue Afterholen and some of the articles you may have read by Paul McEnroe, people are more aware of the problem of people languishing in jail now. But as most legislatures, and we know in our work, coming up with the problems isn't near as easy as coming up with solutions, especially when the problem is as multifaceted and complex as this one. But I'm here today because I urge you to support House File 2562 because it represents a first step, and I would say a giant step forward in getting a handle on these problems. The reason why it is such a major step forward is it begins with the basic premise that the best way to prevent people from languishing in jail is to keep them from going there in the first place. And it does that by working with the reality that exists today. And that reality, if you're a law enforcement officer who runs into someone with mental illness on the street, is that you've got three options. One is to leave the person on the street, and as you might imagine, that rarely leads to any good outcome whatsoever. Second option is to bring a person to the emergency room, and that happens quite often. And as you might expect, that's a very expensive option, and it very rarely produces any long-term outcome that is acceptable. Typically, you spend a lot of money, they get stabilized, they get back in the street, and they come back into the emergency room. That leaves the third option, the only other option that's available now, and that is to bring people to jail. And you've already heard from Sheriff Stanek what happens to the folks that get brought to jail. Nothing good happens. What 2562 does is to create a fourth option. And that's an option where law enforcement can pick up someone who needs some attention and bring them to this mental health hub where professionals could stabilize them when necessary, evaluate them, figure out what treatment plan is appropriate for them, and then line them up with the services that they need, preferably in the community. That's what the goal is, so that they can avoid cycling back through into the emergency room or into the jail. Pretty simple concept, but it's a very effective one. And you may say, well, it sounds like a great concept. How do we know that this has any potential to work? Well, the good news and the bad news in that, and Sheriff Stanek alluded to this, is that this is a nationwide problem. And it has been addressed by some communities throughout the country in various ways, including creating a hub. The one hub that I'm just going to make quick reference to is in Orlando. It's been in existence for over 10 years, and they've kept really good data on what its effect has been. And that data is really amazing, honestly. In the last 10 years, they've served about 47,000 people. They've saved over 100,000 jail bed days, saving somewhere $4 to $5 million in correction costs. You'd probably know that better than I. They've prevented 22,000 emergency room visits and saved a cost, depending on how you calculate it, somewhere between $17 million and $44 million. And they've done this at the same time as limiting law enforcement time in the turnaround to 11 minutes. And maybe that isn't an exact blueprint for us, but what I'd suggest is it gives me confidence, and it should give you confidence, that this is a concept worth exploring, and as long as we can put the pieces in place, one that will serve all of Minnesotans, especially those with mental illness, very well as we go forward.
So, Judge, is the Orlando facility, have you been there?
I haven't been there. I want to go there. I've talked to the judge who created it and to the executive director. I've got a lot of information from them about this. I spent hours, on the phone,
so
getting an understanding of the details of how it works.
So is it more like a hospital, or is it more like a prison, or is it more like a hybrid, or what is it?
I would say that it's probably, if you're familiar with sort of a detox type of facility, it's probably along that line of facility, along with the resources that are in place that go out into the communities to help the folks.
Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really am excited about Representative Hortman, this bill, and the possibilities here, but I do want to bring up some points and some questions and ask just some questions. And it sounds like a facility. It sounds like the hub or the facility is a place where people would receive appropriate care for mental health issues that are being overlooked right now. So that in itself is a positive aspect. But not too long ago, members, we created community-based hospitals rather than have our state institutions. When we created community-based hospitals, We knocked, in my area, we knocked down a bunch of buildings, a bunch of beautiful buildings at the state hospital, and put them in CBHHs, community-based hospitals. And what has happened with that is that it has become difficult to get people into those facilities. That's the reality of it. And the concept is great, but the reality of it is it's been problematic over the last 3 to 4 years. You know, so you talk about a central hub. Are you talking, and I'd like, here's what I would like to know. You know, are you talking about a facility in the state of Minnesota where people would be transported to receive their mental health services? Or are you talking about like a lot of CBHHs around the state of Minnesota where there would be a availability to receive services? So, you know, that's really critical in my opinion, as to this is a statewide opportunity, not just specific to, unless of course you want to put it in Brainerd, then that'd be fine if it was one facility. Then that's, we have plenty of land and possibilities there. But anyhow, so I don't know who's going to answer that question, but that's...
Sounds like the language in the bill says the first one would be in the studied in the metropolitan area, but that it would also look into greater Minnesota for future hubs. But yeah, I'll let the judge respond.
I can start, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ward, and I know Sue Alderholden may have some elaboration on this, but this isn't a way to reinstitutionalize folks. I mean, the concept, as I envision it, and is the way that it's implemented in Orlando and other like facilities, is that this is a temporary place where some people can be brought mainly to be stabilized and to be assessed, with a big function that's also built into this facility to identify places in the community where people could be placed with follow-up services to try to keep them there. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why you close the institutions that weren't bad. I mean, there's a good reason for that. The idea, I think, follows up in what the intention was in closing the institutions, and that try to get people in the community with the services in place. And of course, the answer in the Twin Cities is going to be different than the answer in Brainerd or my hometown of Detroit Lakes or International Falls or elsewhere. And there's still a lot of details that need to be addressed. You know, I think a lot, and this is me, this isn't, you know, anyone else, but I think a lot of the services could be coordinated through this hub statewide, but of course you have to have either resources or places and resources in order to help address the immediate needs of some of the folks. Because you don't want people from Brainerd driving down here, plop them off in the facility just to be brought back up there. I mean, that's not what is going to be in that those people's best interests. Sue?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Abderholden.
Members, I'm Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Actually, I think there's a lot of factors that why we would do it differently than actually in other states right now. With Medicaid expansion, people can actually use their Medicaid dollars if they're not in jail. And so if you have someone who you think they have exhibiting the symptoms of a mental illness, you're going to wait too long in the emergency room, you need to have them in a more of a secure place, you could actually bring them to this. It would have to be small in order to use Medicaid funds, more like a crisis home. But we also didn't want to limit it just to a facility, and especially when you talk about Greater Minnesota. You have the Northern Pines Mental Health Center, where you have your staff actually going into the jails and providing treatment, and that might work better in your community. So I think we want to make sure that we don't have a one-size-fits-all. I think we need to be creative about, you know, dollars that are coming in now that people will have insurance, you know, even if you're through the exchange through a private plan, they have to cover mental health treatment, which wasn't there before. So I think we have some opportunities. Another thing to remember is that anyone brought in through the jail, they do get a screening, a mental health screening, but right now they might not get the assessment. And so this would be a way for us to actually get a diagnostic assessment to find out how can we actually treat that person.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment that everybody working on this is seems to be right on. Just the concerns I brought up with the, you know, going to the community-based hospitals that still are problematic to some extent, but with Ms. Abderholden working on it, it gives me some relief of anxiety, Mr. Chair. So,
thank you for your testimony, Ms. Abderholden. Anything else you want to say?
No, Mr. Chair, other than we support this, we think it's a good idea. Let's be creative. And we've also committed to the Department of Human Services that we will provide staffing to help do some of the research in this area so that their fiscal note isn't as high.
Okay, so that was the next sort of question that we need to address. Representative Portman? There is a cost to your bill, and so I don't know. There's a cost to Health and Human Services, and there's a cost to corrections. And we're running out of time. Representative Hortman.
Senator Goodwin was not under the impression that there would be a fiscal note. So I think the fiscal note is new to us. My understanding from Ms. Adler-Holden is that Senator Goodwin amended the bill to get corrections out of it in the Senate so that there wouldn't be a corrections-related fiscal note. Now, in Representative Liebling's committee, we can do that, and we can see if there's any way to get rid of the rest of the fiscal note.
Okay.
It was my understanding that these individuals would be working on a volunteer basis, and you know, the bill doesn't contemplate conclusions that they're coming to, that they're coming up with a report. So
the fiscal note speaks to that corrections and human services would provide space and administrative support to the working group, and it's estimated that there's looks like 1.5 FTEs. Program consultant, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know what it's all involved, but maybe we should go to Health and Human Service. Why wouldn't it go to Finance? Is Huntley's committee still meeting?
Oh, definitely.
So
Mr. Chair, that committee will be in all day Thursday.
Why don't we move it there? Wouldn't that be a more appropriate place to move it?
I think so, Mr. Chair. I can visit with Representative Liebling, and if she feels that it needs to make a trip to her committee, we can deal with that. I think that we need to amend it to get rid of the administrative support from the agencies. I don't think anybody has the money for that. The idea of 1.5 FTEs working for this working group, it seems a little high to me. But
we just
got volunteer support, I think that's
we just got the fiscal note also, so it's okay, is there anyone else that wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to the bill? Then, any closing comments, Judge? Sheriff?
No, thank you.
Representative Hortman?
Thank you for your consideration.
Representative Cornish, we have a question.
Representative Hortman, did you want to do any of those amendments here or wait till the next
meeting? Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I think it's cleaner when we have something typed up with the revisers. And I will definitely run it by Representative Paymar to make sure that he's satisfied with what we're doing.
Yeah, I think it's really a great bill, and it's really needed, and we need to make it happen. So, the chair will move. Any other questions, comments? The chair will move that House File 2562 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Wortman voted. Then the final bill, I'm just going to do it from here, is my bill. Representative, I will move House File 3273, and this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. And basically what it's doing, it's providing $200,000 to DPS for violence, for sexual violence community prevention grants. These are competitive grants that communities can apply for, organizations can apply for. I understand that $200,000 maybe buys purchases three. So why don't we have Donna Dunn from MnCASA explain what the program does and how these grants could be used. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Donna Dunn, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault,
And I'm very happy to have the opportunity to talk about House File 3273. While this bill was just recently introduced by Representative Paymar, I think many of you know that the conversation about sexual violence and child sexual abuse prevention started in this here in this committee actually very early last year. So we are very pleased to be here to talk about prevention. As you know, MNCASA is a statewide network of sexual assault advocacy programs serving 78 of Minnesota's 87 counties and 6 of the 11 reservations. Well, we know that there's really general agreement that preventing the harm of sexual violence before it begins is an important and a very good goal. We also know that there is a lot of general confusion in the public about how we go about doing that. This bill would give us the opportunity to engage communities and community leaders across the state in the very important work of starting sexual violence prevention initiatives in the context of their communities. For that reason, we think this is a really important approach. The appropriation, I'd like to speak to a couple of things that that sort of speak to why we know this is a good direction to go. This proposal in the bill will help support this prevention work that's based on two tested models. First is the long-standing and successful experience of SMART teams. MNCASA is a state and a national leader and a technical assistance provider to help those who are bringing together community-based criminal justice teams in order to design, to train on, to implement, and to evaluate criminal justice responses to incidents of sexual violence. So we know the intricacies of bringing a multidisciplinary group together and have been noted for that. The second model that I want to sort of call to your attention is that we have been doing a champion communities prevention work in two communities in Minnesota, Bemidji and Winona. That work has been based on our work with SMART teams, but this work in Winona and Bemidji is actually community prevention team work that was funded, a short-term project by the Office of Justice Programs through the Byrne and JAG grants that are a part of the Community Crime Prevention Program from the Department of Justice. So we've got these two experiences of working with community-based teams to solve a problem. So the focus of the proposal that's before you would be to work similarly with communities to pull together a sexual violence, child sexual abuse prevention network in order to have really a collective impact on sexual prevention in a community. We know that there are many things that can be done to help prevent sexual violence, and we also know that there's not one strategy that will actually do the job. This is a complex work, and the response needs to be multifaceted. We do know, however, that there is a body of knowledge that supports the concept of community-based prevention. The Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention at the Department of Justice has said that current opinion views community mobilization strategies as well-founded, as state-of-the-art approach for effective delinquency prevention, and we think that applies here. So the idea of bringing the problem to the community to solve has a lot of support. These networks will figure out which strategies work best to meet the prevention possibilities in their communities. They will work to build joint capacity and pool and maximize the collective efforts in the communities. They will receive technical assistance to help them organize their work and additional resources to help them implement, and evaluate the work that they're doing at the community level. We believe that this is really the most effective model to begin bringing sustainable prevention efforts to communities across the state of Minnesota, and we think the community level work, again, really is the place to start. And we know that this will ultimately contribute to reducing the harm of sexual violence in Minnesota. I'm happy to respond to questions if you want more details about the strategies we're thinking about. I've also got with me Yvonne Cornoyer, who is the prevention coordinator at MNCASA. So thank you.
Would you like to testify?
I can just answer questions.
Okay. So again, Ms. Dunn, so the $200,000 would pay for three grants?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are looking at that would cover three grants to communities. It would also allow us the support to continue for the two communities that we've started working with, that grant is ending at the end of May. This would offer us an opportunity, if they want to continue the strategies they're working on, to also have sort of a mini grant that would allow them to continue. But we're looking at three new sites starting with this funding.
Okay. So this gets added to the your base funding,
Mr. Chair,
throughout through OJP.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And how do other communities apply? How do they know that the grant funds are available?
Well, Mr. Chair, we would the demonstration project that we did with the DOJ funding, we had to actually propose the two communities, and we would actually prefer with this approach to make it a competitive process. At the coalition, we have we work really intensively to get the word out about the what is available. I'm sure that we would work with the Office of Justice Programs to promote the availability, the notice of availability of funds, to make sure that they can help us with that, also reaching out to their grantees.
Okay. Any questions of Ms. Dunn? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. So we're just laying this, the chair will lay over House File 3273. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members.
I think that's it, members. We're adjourned.